Okay, this week's Daf Yomi has all the sugyas of the mitzvah of Kibud Av V'Em, and there's a lot to say about Kibud Av V'Em, so we'll try to get some foundations down. The placement within the Aseres HaDibros is itself noteworthy, because as the Rishonim notes, the first of the two luchos is generally targeted at mitzvot ben adam l'makom, and the second at mitzvot ben adam l'chavero. And yet, you would have thought that Kibud Av V'Em seems like it involves people, seems like it is a mitzvah ben adam l'chavero, and yet it's number five. So that puts it in the first half, in the bottom of the first luch, the first luch, first of the two luchos. So that's what you wouldn't expect. And it seems indeed that it plays somewhat of a bridge role between the two concepts. And there is some discussion as to how to categorize it. Is it a mitzvah ben adam l'chavero, as it seems? It seems like it's about how you interact with human beings. Or should we say that despite that, it's actually a mitzvah ben adam l'makom? So what exactly is the theme of the mitzvah? So why would it be a mitzvah ben adam l'makom? So there are those who suggest that it's a way of showing kavod to the Ribono Shel Olam, but it's hard for us to relate directly to God, and therefore we choose to do so through his human partners in creation that are more relatable. And the Gemara says, Inida shlosha shutven yesh ba'adam, human beings are created by the father, the mother, and the Kodesh Baruch Hu in partnership. So we choose to relate to his human partners as a way of showing honor to God indirectly. And in that sense, perhaps, it is a mitzvah directed at a Kodesh Baruch Hu. I saw in one contemporary sefer an interesting mashal. There was a philanthropist that wanted to help out his local city. So he created a free restaurant where all those who were in need could come and get meals. And after a while, he was wondering whether it was appreciated or not. It seemed like it was being made good use of, but he wanted to know if people were appreciating it, but couldn't tell because he did it anonymously. So nobody was going to say anything to him because they didn't know that he was the donor. So when he came up with this idea to find out if people were appreciating it, he put hidden cameras in the restaurant. And he decided that he would figure it out by watching to see if the people who came to the restaurant, if they were grateful to the waiters. If they were nice to the waiters, so that would be an indication that they appreciated what he was doing. So too, this mashal suggests that the Kadosh Baruch Hu looks to see how do you treat his partners. If you're nice to your parents, so then that's an indication that you appreciate his creation of humanity, and therefore that's a way of showing honor to God. And the notion that the Torah tells us that the schar for Kibud Av V'Em is l'man yarichun yamecha, the promise of a long life, even though the Gemara says that doesn't necessarily mean long life in the literal sense in this world, but could mean olam haba, but assuming that it does have some connection to the literal meaning of life in this world. So the understanding is that it's a midah keneged midah, because through your kibud av v'em, that's your way of showing your appreciation for the fact that you have life in the first place. So therefore it makes sense that midah keneged midah should be rewarded with more yamim hala adama. So that would be a way to see it as connected to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. But the more intuitive understanding is that it's about relationship to your parents directly. And in that context, so many invoke the theme of Hakar Satov. And Hakar Satov, of course, being a foundational principle in Judaism, one of the most important Ikarim, if not perhaps the most important Ikar. We read about it in the Parsha 2 weeks ago when we read Parsha Kisavo, and started with the theme of Bikurim, and the notion of we should emphasize that we're not Kfuye Tova, that we have to express and to certainly feel our gratitude. And as the Rishonim explain, that the expression of Hakar Satov to our parents is the most obvious and fundamental way to convey that Midah. under normal circumstances. But what's worth noting, and I think this is something that we'll note in further examples, is that the reference to Hakaras HaTov that you see in the context of Kibbud Av Ve'Eim really is in two different ways. On the one hand, you see it as what we call a Piron Chov, that it's essentially reciprocity, that here your parents have done things for you under normal circumstances. On the most basic level, they brought you into the world, and usually it's more than that, but certainly it starts with at least that. So there is a notion of reciprocity, and we call Piron Chov, to pay off a debt. And as the Chayyadim and others say, that you shouldn't think, well, there's nothing to pay off here because this is automatically understood. If somebody brings you into the world and they have to take care of you, it's not anything that you should feel any special gratitude for. He says that's the worst thing in the world to feel that way. You have to recognize that that also is deserving of gratitude and you shouldn't take it as automatic or expected. And in addition to the notion of Piron Chov, there is an attitude of gratitude, as the expression goes, but just the awareness, the phrase, Hakaras HaTov, doesn't only refer to what's expressed and what is manifest, but just the awareness and the appreciation of having benefited. And as the Rishonim point out, that here, this is the key to essentially everything, and if you're not able to feel Hakaras HaTov to the most basic benefactors, again, under normal circumstances, of the individual that one normally encounters, then the chances are you're not going to feel Hakaras HaTov in any other setting or to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and that's going to be a tremendous flaw. So there's a difference between those two emphases in terms of Hakaras HaTov, and that's something that we'll come back to. So the idea that it could be either Ben Adam L'Makom or Ben Adam L'Chaveiro, so may tie in to these two reasons, but I don't know if it really matters that much, whether you call it one or the other. It's interesting just to try to discuss it in terms of where it comes from. Does it have much of a nafkamina? I'm not sure, because when we talk about nafkaminas for categorizing mitzvos, when there's Ben Adam L'Makom and Ben Adam L'Chaveiro, so let's say there are two nafkaminas that come to mind, but I don't know, practically speaking, how much either of them are really going to make a difference. Two of the nafkaminas that come to mind, they both are identified by the same word, but in different usages of that word. The word mechila. So we're approaching now Yom Kippur. We know the Mishnah says that one difference between Ben Adam L'Chaveros and Ben Adam L'Makom is that when you come to do tshuva before Yom Kippur, if you commit an avera Ben Adam L'Chavero, you have to seek out their mechila before Yom Kippur. And if it's Ben Adam L'Makom, then the tshuva that you do is just between you and God. That's one potential nafkamina. Another nafkamina has to do with the concept of mechila in another usage, meaning who has the right to be mechil, who has the right to say, it's okay, you don't have to do this particular obligation. So theoretically, that would be two nafkaminas of the question of whether this is Ben Adam L'Makom or Ben Adam L'Chavero. These are concepts that the Menachem Sinuch talks about in his treatment of the mitzvah of Kibbud Av Ve'Eim. But practically speaking, neither one is really going to make so much of a difference. Because we talk about, let's say, asking for mechila for violating Kibbud Av Ve'Eim, it's going to be pretty much the same thing. Because if we see it as a Ben Adam L'Chavero, if somebody fails in the area of Kibbud Av Ve'Eim, as we all do, because it's a very demanding mitzvah, so no one's going to be perfect in this. As the Gemara in recent Daf Yomi indicates, it's a standard that's very hard to live up to. So then you have to ask for mechila, certainly if it's Ben Adam L'Chavero, so certainly you have to ask for mechila to do tshuva for that. But even if you say that it was purely a Ben Adam L'Makom, so you still have to do tshuva by fixing it. And fixing it is presumably going to require apologizing to your parents for however you failed to live up to the standard. So practically speaking, it's going to involve apologizing to parents one way or another. So it's hard to see if that's a real nafkamina of major consequence. And then the other usage of the word mechila, so who is the one who has the right to be meichel beforehand on a particular obligation. So it sounds on the surface like that's an area where there is a potential nafkamina, because you would say that if the parents are the beneficiaries of the mitzvah, so that they could be mochel, they could say, it's all right, we don't need this particular requirement. And, but if it's really about God, so then maybe it's not up to the parents to be mochel. Maybe it's God's mitzvah, and the parents don't have the right to be mochel. So you could think, theoretically, that that's a nafkamina. But the truth is, the Gemara already addresses this, and the Gemara says that, in contrast to a king, so melech shemochel, al kvodo in kvodo mochel. A king does not have the right to be mochel on his kavod. That's the nation's dignity. He has to insist on his dignity. But av shemochel al kvodo kvodo mochel. So the Gemara already answered this question. The Gemara says that a parent does have the right to be mochel on his kavod. So it sounds like the Gemara is settling this issue. But not necessarily, because what the Gemara seems to mean by that is not really that the parent has the right to remove this concept. It means more in the spirit of zehu kvodo, that the parent has the right to determine what kind of kavod they want. So they're not really making the concept go away. It means that they can tell you what they want for the fulfillment of the mitzvah of kavod. So it's not really a proof that they're the ones who control the concept. It still could be that you are mechabed your parents because that's a way of showing kavod to God. But as part of that kavod, the parents get to define what they're really interested in and what they're not interested in. And consistent with that point is that they really don't have the right to kind of completely negate the concept. And as the Netziv points out in the Tshuva, and others argue, the parent probably doesn't have the right and certainly shouldn't allow themselves to be mevuzeh, to say that you can degrade them or to really negate their status as a parent. They can define what they want in terms of kavod, but to really treat themselves as equals or less than equals, that wouldn't be appropriate, and that has ramifications lahalacha, and that's something also to keep in mind, that there really should be a distinction between the parent and child. It's just the specific format of what the kavod entails. So when the Gemara says that av shemachal al kvod al kvod amachal, it doesn't really mean that the parent has the complete control in order to make the concept disappear, but it means that they can direct how that kavod should be formulated. So it doesn't necessarily mean that they control the principle completely. While we're addressing that point, so it's interesting to note that there is a question that you could ask about a very practical matter, that the Gemara says clearly, explicitly, that kibud av aim applies even after the parents are no longer alive. There's still a obligation of kibud av aim that continues. And there are many who suggest that that is the reason for the difference in avelos practices for parents as opposed to all other relatives. So in general, if another one of the seven relatives passes away, Rachman al-Flan, so there's an obligation of Shiva, and then there's another obligation on the lower level of Shloshim. So for a parent, you have those, and then you also have avelos that goes the whole rest of the year, Yud Beis Chodesh. So many understand that to be a function of the mitzvah of kibud av aim. That's why there's this whole additional element. So if that's the case, so then, as the Shach and others point out, so presumably if there's a concept of mechila by kibud av aim, so then there should also be a concept of mechila by that avelus. But you don't see that so often. You don't see that in practice. And it's an interesting question, why not? Because it would have major, major ramifications for people's lives, and many people struggle greatly with issues of avelus and some of the details of going to weddings and other such practices. And if mechila really was an option, so you would think you'd see it more often. And I discussed this once with the Rosh Weiss, that you think that, first of all, on paper, it seems like it should be a possibility. And then once it's a possibility, does it have to be expressed? Because you might think also it could be assumed, because we find in Luminous that if it's, there's an umdura, that if it's obvious that somebody is mochel, then you can take it for granted that that's the case. So there are many situations where people are in very difficult circumstances because of the veilless questions, and it's clear the parents wouldn't want them to be in such awkward situations. So maybe you could say that You could take it as a given. They would have been mochel under these circumstances. So I asked him about that. Should that make sense? And he said, theoretically, yes, but maybe we don't say that because the whole concept of avelus would fall away if people gave themselves that license. So I thought maybe you could give a different explanation, just to explain the phenomenon, so to speak, of why you so rarely see this in practice. Why do we so rarely see anyone availing themselves of mechila for Yud Beis Chodesh when theoretically, on paper, it seems like it should be an option? I think you could maybe explain that there is a difference in terms of the nature of avelus, the nature of kibud avim, when a parent is alive, and the kibbutz that the Gemara talks about, l'achar miso, which, and the Gemara certainly says it exists, but it seems to be of a different nature. So, and we'll talk in a few minutes a little bit more about the nature of kibbutz av'eim in general. So, kibbutz av'eim, as we'll explain a little bit more about, when the parent is alive, is mostly about service, mostly about doing what the parent wants. When the parent is no longer alive, so it's not about that, because we're not looking necessarily to make them happy. The discussion in the sugi and Masach's Brachos about what people who aren't alive, what they know about, what they don't know about, that's not the general assumption of kibud av aim when the parents are no longer alive. The function is more about the literal word kavod, means kabed, means to give weight to, means to give esteem, to give honor to a parent. It's about doing things that give them stature. So we make donations in their honor, you name yeshivas after them. Saying Kaddish is a way of showing that they raised people who are maminim. You do things that give honor in the literal sense. That's why in Parshas Kisavo, the Arurim, so the opposite of Kavod, is Makleh of Avivimo, somebody who makes their parents light. That's the opposite of Kavod, Kaved and Makleh. So it's more a literal kind of Kavod. A person gives Chashivas to the parents. So it takes on a different format. That's what the Achronim explained, the Kiveger and the Modiori explained, that it takes on a different nature. So even though theoretically the concept of Mechila maybe applies across the board, because that's the way we have it as a notion, but still the mechanics of Mechila make much more sense when you're dealing with a living parent, because when a parent is alive, so the nature of kibud av aim is doing what they want. So they have the right to define what they want. So they say, okay, I'm not interested in this, so then mechila makes sense. But when the parent's no longer alive, so the nature of the kavod is doing things that give them stature. So the concept of mechila, even if technically it applies, it just doesn't work as well. So the idea that they can say, I'm not interested in this, it's not going to have the same kind of logic to it. So even if on paper it's theoretically there, I want to suggest that maybe the reason we don't find this playing out as often is because the logic of mechila doesn't fit as well with the type of kavod that is given to a parent that is no longer alive, the way that it does to the kavod of a parent who is alive. And maybe that's why the
minute. Was the type of person who liked to do things more low key?
So that particular practice, maybe so, but the idea of dispensing with the avelus as a whole. So, for example, for somebody to be going to weddings and parties during the Yud Beis Chodesh, so why is it you don't find that so often? That's what I'm referring to, right?
The parents said in advance before they passed away, by the way, maybe those obligations.
Right. So technically, that is possible, and there are some who do that. The question, what I'm asking here, is why is that so rare?
Not
no one. There are people who do it, but it's. Considering how many people struggle mightily with avelus questions, why is it so rare? Why don't you see this more often?
So, other people that know that their parent just recently passed away, and they
so that's what I'm saying. That's consistent with the point that it's going to create a little bit of a funny impression for people. So that awkwardness is just much less compatible with the normal notion of mechila. So when you have a living parent and the parent says, "Listen, I know that kibud av aim requires you to do this, but it's not what I want," so the logic of mechila fits better. But when the parent is no longer alive, even if they did say that I'm fine with you going to weddings for this year, but the picture that will create is a little bit less consistent with the logic of mechila that we have, even if technically on paper it could make sense, and even if there are poskim who have said it makes sense, and there certainly are, I think just to explain the minhag olam, why this is something that we encounter so much less frequently, despite the fact that people really have a very hard time time sometimes with the pressures of Avelis to Beis Chodesh. I think maybe that might be a suggestion to explain why we don't find it in practice as often. So the idea of Kibud Av Eim as an expression of Hakaras HaTov, so logic would then indicate probably that there is some degree of kavod that is applicable to an adoptive parent. Whether or not that's the actual idea of Kibud Av Eim is subject to debate. As Gemara and Sota, it sounds like it's not an actual chiyuv discussion in the Shu'a Tzchem Sofer and others. But as Rav Moshe Feinstein and others point out, that it certainly seems that, logically speaking, the Svara would apply. What exactly we're referring to when we say Hakaras HaTov? So there's what the debate, whether it means the Hakaras HaTov just for being brought into this world. Does it mean more than that? Does it mean being raised? Is there somewhat of a sliding scale of just how much Hakaras HaTov is the subject to discussion? But it certainly would seem to follow that to whatever extent one owes a person gratitude for being raised, for being hosted for an extended period of time, that there should be some kind of a correlating obligation, and there is a extensive literature to that effect. So what also is the subject of much discussion, so the Gemara does say, and Chazal say in a few places, the Gemara in the recent Dapim here in Kedushin, and also Midrashim, identify that the primary manifestation of Kibud Av Eim, so the Chazal in a few places have a list of actions, a list of things that we do in service, machilo, mashkehu, we provide food, we provide drink, we provide clothing, malbisho, different actions in different places. But presumably it's not an exhaustive list, and the intent of these lists are that you provide acts of service to the parent, whatever the parent asks for, so that is what is included as the primary manifestation of the mitzvah. But what about a parental instruction? So if the parent says, I want you to do something, that's not about their personal service. So is that included in the mitzvah of Kibud Av Eim? So that was in Mechlokes Rishonim. There were a number of Rishonim commenting on the Gemara in the beginning of Yevamos and elsewhere, where it sounds like they didn't think it was necessarily included in the obligation, because there are a few sugyas, the Gemara there in Yevamos and Shabbos and elsewhere, where the Gemara derives from Sukkim that there is no obligation or permission, really, to follow a parental instruction that contradicts the Torah. So the Gemara says, if a parent says to be Mochal Shabbos, or the parent tells you to do a different Aveira, a parent tells a Kohen to go into the Beis HaKvaris, whatever it is, so they're not supposed to listen. And the Rishonim discuss, why is that even a discussion? Why is that even a drasha? Because the impression you have is that the Gemara is teaching you that, oh, if a parent tells you to do an aveir, you shouldn't listen. It's as if there's a conflict between the mitzvah of Kibud Av Eim and the Torah's commandment, and the Torah's commandment wins. But what's the conflict? There's no mitzvah of Kibud Av Eim in that case, because Kibud Av Eim doesn't require you to follow every instruction. Kibud Av Eim is about service to a parent. So it doesn't mean just to do whatever they instruct you to do. So why is that a conflict between Kibud Av Eim and whatever mitzvah? There's no mitzvah in the first place in that case. So those Rishonim seem to be assuming that Kibud Av Eim is not about following every instruction. It's only about when it's in the context of service. And if it's just a random instruction that doesn't benefit the parent, so then that's not included in Kibud Av Eim. But there is a slight deviation in the way the Rashba presents that statement. And the Vilna Gaon and others picked up on this formulation, and they thought it was significant. So the way the Rashba says it, he makes the same point, but he says it just slightly differently, and that difference might be noteworthy. So the Rashba says that this idea of following a random parental instruction, he doesn't say that it's nothing. He says that that's not the Iker mitzvah of Kibud Av Eim that would have been significant enough that it could have gone to battle against another Torah mitzvah that you need to be told that it loses. So that phrasing, that it's not the Iker mitzvah, it makes it sound like it is something. It's just not the main mitzvah of Kibbut Av Eim. So that implication that there's some value in following a parental instruction, it's just not the main mitzvah. So that generated a lot of discussion, and many Sfarim tried to understand what he's getting at, the Rashba, that when he's suggesting that there's something to be said for following a parental instruction, it's just not the main mitzvah. So what does he mean by that? Some suggest maybe it's a mitzvah d'rabbanan to follow a general parental instruction. Maybe it's some other kind of a peripheral mitzvah. There are those who suggest that maybe it's a different mitzvah, that we also have a mitzvah in the Torah, a different pasuk in Parshas Kedoshim, Yishimo v'aviv tiro, the mitzvah of mora av'aim. So it's an interesting question what the distinction is between kibud av'aim and mora av'aim. So there's some Rishonim who count it as one and understand that it's not really a different mitzvah, it's two different iterations of the same idea. It sounds like the way it's presented in the Gemara that Kibbut Av Eim is really the positive version. The things that you do to honor your parents is Kibbut Av Eim. The things that you don't do because it's disrespectful, that's Mora Av Eim, etc., etc. So that's a whole discussion. But there are some who suggest that maybe you're obligated to follow a parental instruction because if you don't, then that's a violation of Mora. So maybe that's where it comes in, not because of the Kibbut Av Eim having such a mandate, but Mora means you can't refuse. So that was itself a discussion. The Sefer HaMakneh in Kiddushin has that suggestion. A few others have that. So that's a good question whether that's true or not. If there is a truth to that, so it may depend on how. So, for example, it could be a question of degree. It could be that if a parent asks you to do something, and you say, no way, you're not the boss of me, so then maybe that's a violation of Mora. But if you say that, listen, I appreciate that you want me to do this, but it's just a completely unreasonable ask right now, given I have to raise my family and take care of my kids, and you want me to just walk around the block 100 times, and I just wish I love you very much, but I can't do it, you know, that might not be a violation of Mora. So it may depend on how exactly one declines. Or it may make a difference if the parent is present or not. It could be, are we talking about the parent asking you to do something and they're not going to know? Or are you talking about refusing when they're watching? So there may not be one answer to that question if every refusal to follow a parental command is a violation of Mora or not. So that was one of the suggestions also, that maybe Mora is relevant to this question. So I think you could also suggest a little bit differently that the issue of what the Rashba is getting at, this draws upon what we were noting before, that the language of Hakar Satov that the Rishonim bring up when explaining Kibbut Av Eim exists in two different formulations. So there is the Piron Hachov, the reciprocity concept, and there also is the idea of the mindset of Hakar Satov. So maybe they both play out in different ways. So the Iker mitzvah, the main mitzvah of Kibbut Av Eim, is really reciprocity. So that means it's really service. And the idea is that just like parents in the normal situation, so they provide service for children when they're raising them. So as a reciprocity, at Piron Chov, it's proper for the children then to provide similar services to the parents. So that's the basic main mitzvah of Kibbut Av Eim. But also a part of Kibbut Av Eim is a mindset of appreciation and recognizing that everything that you have is because the parents brought you here in the first place. So because of that mindset, it makes sense that when it's possible and reasonable, you also would want to fulfill a instruction if it's not inconsistent with living a normal life. So for a child to say that I'm just not interested in doing what the parent wants because I don't care, so that's going to be incompatible with the mindset of Hakar Satov. So perhaps that's what the Rashba is getting at, that even though the main mitzvah of Kibbut Av Eim is these actions of service, that's reciprocity, but the mindset of Hakar Satov is going to mean that it's probably, when it's reasonable and possible, it's indicated to follow parental commands also. But that's just not the main mitzvah. And also, this could explain the other language that he has when he says that the main mitzvah of reciprocity, that's where you need to be told that it doesn't override a mitzvah. So that makes sense also, because the whole question of what could possibly conflict and go to battle with another mitzvah, that's when you have a debt to somebody. L'mashal, let's say somebody wants to make aliyah. He says a mitzvah to make aliyah. But he also borrowed a lot of money from people, and so he has big debts. But he says, well, too bad, I have a mitzvah to make aliyah, so I'm just going to forget about my debts and leave. So you'll say, no, pay off your debts first, and then you'll perform the mitzvah. So there's a discussion about what takes priority, your obligations towards other people or your personal spiritual fulfillment. So it's reasonable to ask, okay, if I have a debt to my parents of reciprocity and a conflict with the mitzvah, what takes priority? But that's the discussion, because reciprocity, indeed, is what to ask about what comes first. So that's what Rashi was saying. The reciprocity, that's where you have such a question. But the other idea of just following a parental instruction is not helping them. So that, there's a value to it, because it goes to the mindset of Hakar Sato. So yes, it's not nothing, but you don't need to be told that that doesn't override other mitzvos, because it doesn't rise to that level. And that's perhaps what he's saying. So, just to say a few words about the general question about what happens when instructions from parents do come into conflict with other things, and it certainly does, so it does it from time to time, so there is a major literature about this, and it does bring in the course of that literature, a lot of the other principles. So just to say for a few minutes about this, so one of the major arenas of this discussion is the question of marriage. So what happens when there is a conflict between a parent and a child regarding a marriage choice? So this is discussed in the Ramah. The Ramah quotes the Maharik that if a parent tells a child, and this actually is going to segue back to something we talked about in our Hakdamah to Gittin, if you recall, that if a parent tells a child that they can't marry the one they're interested in, they have to marry someone else. So the Ramah, according to the Maharik, says the child's not obligated to listen. And he gives three reasons why. So it's very interesting, because the three reasons all draw on different principles in Kibud Av Vaim. So the question is, do you need all three reasons? So that's the Mefarshim try to figure out. And it's always interesting when there's more than one reason, what's the interaction between them, or what's the necessity for them. But a part of it is that not all three reasons will always apply. The circumstances could certainly vary between the different cases, and you could certainly tweak the cases so that the different reasons will have different levels of impact. But just to consider what the reasons are. So the first, or however you order them, so one of the reasons is that it says against the Torah. And we saw that you don't have to listen to a parent, you're maybe not supposed to listen when it's against the Torah. So it's a mitzvah to get married, so it's against the Torah in this situation. Now, that's not so obvious, because the parent's not necessarily saying, don't get married. The person's saying, don't marry this one, marry that one. Now, it could be that the parent is saying, don't get married, but in the case under discussion, the parent's not saying, don't get married, saying, marry somebody else. So why is that against the Torah? So apparently, there's a big chiddush coming out of this Marik, that part of the mitzvah to get married, assuming there aren't some other Yisurim or Halach principles involved, that a part of the mitzvah to get married is to marry the person who you feel is the most compatible. So if the parent is saying, no, you can't marry that person, or you marry somebody else, that is a violation or a deficiency in the performance of the mitzvah, and that becomes relevant to that. So that's a very striking idea. So this, we talked about the Hakdamah to Gittin. So there was a whole discussion that when Gerushin is not justified, is there an Isser of Gerushin? So the Mishnah Melech quotes a tshuva of the Rivash that says that he quotes as saying there's an Isser of Gerushin, because he just quotes that one line that if a parent tells a child to divorce, so you're not supposed to listen. So it made it sound like there's an Aveira of Gerushin because of that idea going against the Torah. But if you look at it inside, I think he means in this sense that just like the parent says, don't marry the person you want to marry, so it's a deviation from the Torah in this sense. So if a child is happily married and the parent says, I want you to divorce the person you're happily married to, it's that same Aveira, so to speak. It's that same lack of proper adherence to this mitzvah, and that's what it means. It's a fascinating idea. The second argument that he has there is this idea that we're talking about, that the parent doesn't have the right to instruct the child on things that are not necessarily related to their service. So Kibbutz Av Eim says, bring me my lunch, but it doesn't mean necessarily here's how you live your life. So this isn't included in the mitzvah of Kibbutz Av Eim, according to those Rishonim, which the Ma'arik take as authoritative. The third is another principle that the recent daf talked about, which has to be properly understood, that the Gemara has a discussion. So when the parent says, bring me a sandwich, bring me a jacket, so that's certainly included in Kibbutz Av Eim. But what the Gemara debates is, so who pays for the sandwich? Or who pays? If it's a new jacket, who pays for the jacket? So do we say Kibbutz Av Mishalav, the father pays for it, or we say Mishal Ben? So that's a machlokes in the Gemara. But the conclusion is Mishalav, that the father has to pay for it. So the son says, okay, I'll bring you a sandwich, but give me your credit card, so you'll pay for the sandwich, I'll pick it up, the physical act of obtaining the sandwich, so that the son's supposed to do. But he has the right to say, give me your credit card, so you'll pay for it. Unless the father can't afford to pay for it, so then the son should pay for the sandwich. And then it's a discussion, Meforshim, is that the son's supposed to pay for it as a mitzvah of Kibbutz Av Eim, or maybe that's a mitzvah of Tzedakah. So that's a discussion under what heading should he pay for it, but that's if the father can't afford. But the father can afford, so then the father's supposed to pay for it. So that's the conclusion we say Mishalav. Now, personally, I think there's some degree of misinterpretation of that Gemara, that people take it to mean that somehow Kibbutz Av Eim is the only mitzvah in the Torah that you're not obligated to spend a cent on. Lulav, tefillin, that's all expensive. You know, that, you get a drive to shul, you gotta pay for the gas and everything like that, but this is the one mitzvah that's not supposed to cost you a nickel. And they take it to great extremes. So there's a story, for example, they say in the name of Chaim Brisker, that somebody said to him that my father lives in Warsaw and he wants me to visit him, but the train from Brisk to Warsaw is expensive, so I think, you know, Kibbutz Av Mishalav, I think I don't have to go. So Chaim responded, he said, you're right, the train is expensive, so Kibbutz Av Mishalav, you don't have to pay for the train. So walk. So I think, you know, it's meant to be a clever answer, but I think the whole question is based on a misconception. I don't think the Gemara means to say that this is the one mitzvah that you're not supposed to ever spend a nickel on. I think the Gemara, that line in the Gemara is coming right after the Gemara says that you bring sandwiches and you bring clothes to the parent. So it's addressing that one detail, that when you provide these items the parent is asking for, so who pays for the items? But it doesn't mean that nothing in Kibbutz Av Eim can ever cost you. The basic things that cost you in every other area of life, it should cost you in Kibbutz Av Eim also. But, okay, so there is this basic policy that Kibbutz Av Mishalav. So, as a Kal Vachomer from there, so the Ma'arik says, if your father says to you, you can't marry the person you want to spend the rest of your life with, don't spend your life with that person, but instead spend the rest of your life with the person I want you to. So whose budget does that come out of? You know, who pays for that, so to speak? So, Ein Locha Mishal Ben Gadol Mizeh. It doesn't come out of your, well, kind of a Kal Vachomer. It doesn't have to come out of your wallet, and this is much more than coming out of your wallet. So, however you understand that concept, is certainly a much greater sacrifice than that. So he understands that that's not included within Kibbutz Av Eim. So those are the three principles that he lays down there, three foundations for this psak. But it's also important to appreciate that every one of those can be tweaked because the circumstances could vary. So sometimes the details may very much depart from some of those things. Sometimes it may be relevant to a parent's service. Somebody who wants to get married and move to a very far away place, it's going to impact the parent's ability to be serviced at all by the child. Doesn't mean that that's necessarily going to dictate the decisions, but it's not irrelevant. And as Siv points out, so there is also the aspect of Bizayin sometimes. I have to figure out how that plays out. As the Chazon Ish noted, that also inherent to the parental identity is the idea that they have some greater insight into the marital choices than the child does. So to say to a parent, you have no wisdom about this, is a very profoundly hurtful kind of interaction. So one has to really be very careful about this. And when these kinds of clashes come up, And they certainly do. I don't think the path of wisdom for either side is to say, well, Marik says this, and the parent says, well, the Chazirish does that. You know, and they go back and forth. It's not the way to harmony, and no one's going to have a happy life by settling the issue by pointing to any mucker or the other. When push comes to shove, there's a reason why the literature discusses these things and why there are foundational principles. But in the real life situations that develop, it's important to address them with chachma and probably get third parties who are wiser and able to be diplomatic involved and try to get the two sides to a happier place. But there's a reason why there still needs to be a literature that explains the yesodos of how these develop. But it goes to the essence of what are the core principles involved. Questions involving Aliyah draw on very similar principles. A lot of the same ideas come up. There are also separate sources that talk about it. That's its own discussion. But a lot of this sheds light on some of the core ideas of the mitzvah of Kibbutz Avim. And many of these are sugyas that have been discussed in the daf in these past few days. There are many, many more that they're talking about. But there is limited time, and it's Erev Rosh Hashanah, so we have to do tshuva on many things. But one of the major things to do tshuva about is Kibbutz Avim, like we mentioned in the parsha of Kisavo. So he said one of the arurs is arur maklav of imo. So I saw in the sefer L'sitcha Elyon, he quotes an idea that there are people who, so here it's just the day before Rosh Hashanah, is that there are people who travel thousands of miles to get brachas from rabbis and tzaddikim of all kinds, but it'd be much more efficient. All of Klal Yisrael said amen to a bracha and a klala for people who are not careful about kibbutz avim. So you could save all the traveling and just be nicer to your parents, and it'll get a much better source of a bracha and a klala. It was endorsed by all of Klal Yisrael, so it's a much more effective way of getting a very powerful bracha. So that's something to think about. But I also just note that so I wrote a sefer about kibbutz avim, and I included a line there that the person I gave it to proofread and to edit changed in a way that I didn't catch before it was published, and I didn't really love this change. That so if a parent tells you to violate a din min haTorah midrabbanan, so you're not supposed to listen. But what if you want to take on a chumrah and the parent doesn't want you to take on the chumrah? So it's an interesting discussion whether you should prefer the chumrah or listen to the parent. And you could make a case that you don't have to listen to the parent telling you not to take on this chumrah. But you could also make the case that you could listen to the parent, and all poskim would probably agree that if you choose to listen to a parent when they make an instruction like this, that it's a kiyum in kibbutz avim. You may not be obligated to, but it's probably a kiyum in kibbutz avim. So it's an interesting question, what's the more advantageous spiritual path, so to take on this chumrah or to fulfill one of the Aseret HaDibros. So it's probably the bigger accomplishment to fulfill one of the Aseret HaDibros. So I wrote this in my sefer, and I just ended the siman that way. I wrote V'halo Davarhu, something to think about, that that's a path to one of the Aseret HaDibros, probably the wiser path. So the editor changed it to Halo Dvar Mitzvahu, which is a much softer, but it's not the way I wanted to end the point. But in any event, it's something to think about, that out of all the different schoolas that we chase after sometimes, and all the different far off ways to get the zchus, that probably a much more readily available way, and we should be privileged to have the opportunity for as long as we can to be able to fulfill the mitzvah of kibbutz avim to whatever extent possible, is one of the biggest sources of zchus around, and we should take every opportunity to avail ourselves of that. As we look towards Yom HaDin, is a tremendous opportunity. So bless everyone with all possible sources of bracha for the new year, and look forward to seeing you soon.